Life of Caliph Ali by Abul Hasan Ali Nadwi. Chapter 4. Life of Caliph Ali under the reign of Khalif Omar. Nomination of Omar as Khalifa. Omar was nominated as Caliph after the death of Abu Bakr. Abu Bakr had nominated him as a vicegerent because of his sound judgment, foresight and firm determination, the qualities required for the head of a developing state and society. Islam was then emerging as a world power. Rapid conquests were, for the first time in history, bringing vast and extensive countries under the control of the Arabs. It was a crucial time with new and intricate problems required to be solved quickly and successfully. Byzantine and Iran, the two great empires of the day, were on the verge of being overpowered. All that wealth and labor could produce for the enjoyment of life was finding its way in abundance to Arabia, where people had been used to leading a nomadic or a semi-nomadic life in leather tents or earthen houses. Let alone the appliances of comfort, they were not even aware of things of daily use in the cultured parts of the world. When the Arabs saw camphor for the first time in Iraq, they took it as some kind of a salt, and someone even used it for kneading the dough. The Muslim Arab conquerors were faced with new and complicated situations. They had, on one hand, to preserve their austere way of life, Islamic values, and martial qualities strictly in accordance with the ideal society of the days of the Prophet and his companions. On the other, assume the leadership of cultured countries and nations far ahead of them culturally and intellectually, and administer them effectively. The nomination of Omar to take over as Khalifa in such an unsettled and puzzling situation, wherein he had to preserve the integrity of Islam and demonstrate its moral superiority over the so-called cultured debased societies and their social orders prevalent all over the world, seems to have been divinely inspired. He was fully competent to overtake this difficult task. Absolutely sincere and firm as he was, he succeeded eminently in keeping up the Prophet's message and the Prophet's mission. Omar was respected as well as feared by all. The awe he inspired through his stern yet just leadership was such that he deposed the Muslim general Khalid bin Walid, titled as the Sword of Allah by the Prophet, when his exploits in warfare had earned him the name of an invincible commander and the Muslims were facing a mammoth army of the Byzantines at Yarmouk. Omar removed Khalid bin Walid and placed him under Abu Ubaidah, the new commander-in-chief. A critical situation was created. Pride and self-interest could have played havoc at that time, but Omar commanded such an awe, and Khalid was so perfect in faith, that Khalid, on receiving the orders of demonation, spontaneously said, "I have listened and obeyed to the leader of the Muslims." When somebody said to Khalid bin Walid that the change at this decisive hour might prove to be perilous for the Muslims, he replied, "So long as Omar lives, there is no danger of any insurgency." Khalid bin Walid was the most popular Muslim general who had never been defeated. His compliance with the Khalifa's order and his willingness to serve as an ordinary soldier was unprecedented in the history of warfare. At the same time, the incident also speaks volumes of the awe of Khalifa Omar and his firm hold over the affairs of the state and the Muslim army. The affairs of the governor of Egypt, Amr bin As, is of historic significance. His son, Muhammad, and an Egyptian Christian had a horse competition. The Christian won the horse competition, but Muhammad bin Amr bin As insisted on oath that his horse had left the competitor's horse behind. The Christian also sweared that he had won the race, which made Muhammad bin Amr bin As lose his temper. Filled with anger, he beat the Copt, saying, "Take it, I am the grandee's son." The Copt complained to Omar, who sent Amr bin As and his son to be brought to Medina. When they arrived, Umar gave a whip to the Copt to beat Amr's son. He also said to Amr bin As, "When have you made slaves of people who were born free to their mothers?" The simple living of the Arabs. The nation of Islam was then passing through a period of transition which was as crucial for it as it was as it is always for other developing nations. The Arabs had just crossed the threshold of their nomadic existence and come across the sophistications of cultured and urban societies in other countries. They had been accustomed to live in tents, tending to their sheep and camels, and milking them and living for their milk and meat. In the countries they conquered, they found devices of ease and comfort, of flourish and magnificence. To live in moderation at this juncture was quite a difficult task, and it was very delicate. But this feat was accomplished by Umar. No change took place in his personal life. The same austere and simple way of life he retained as he was accustomed to lead before assuming the charge of the caliphate. At the same time, he remained so studiously watchful that the Arabs did not adapt the urbane alien culture. Wealth was pouring in from all sides with expanding conquests, but he strictly watched that it was not spent on luxuries. Ibn Kathir reports in Al-Bidayah wa Nihaya that, quote, "When Umar went to Jerusalem, he found the Prophet's companions wearing clothes which were loose overgarments made of a kind of satin. Umar could not bear that sight, and he asked them to remove those clothes. He permitted them to wear those robes when they pleaded that they were in a state of war which required them to wear those robes for keeping their arms in readiness." Tariq bin Shihab relates, quote, "When Umar was going to Syria, he found a river in his way. He got down from the camel, took off his socks and crossed it on foot with his camel. The people there were amazed that he did not take the assistance of any servant. Thereupon, Abu Ubaidah remarked, 'You have shown yourself to be too simple for these men.' Umar stroked Abu Ubaidah's chest and replied, 'O Abu Ubaidah, would that somebody else had made this remark. Abu Ubaidah, you are people who were treated as lowly, humble and insignificant by others. Islam conferred honor on you, and if you want it now, through anything else other than Islam, Allah will debase you again." Unquote. Umar once sent a directive to his governors posted outside of Arabia in which he wrote, quote, "Do not take to the comforts and dresses of the non-Arabs, nor give up the habit of working in the sun, for it is the bath of the Arabs. Carry on with your austere and frugal way of life. Keep yourself accustomed to rough and wooden beds, and wear coarse and worn-out clothes. Do not be unmindful of keeping your lances and ride your horses by jumping on them, and continue to practice archery." Unquote. Another utterance attributed to Umar demonstrates his keen sense of moral values and firm determination to maintain them at all costs. He is reported to have said, quote, "Islam is now forging ahead. The Quraysh want to treat the wealth bestowed by God as subsidy to them and become indifferent to his worshipful obligations. But they should know, as long as Umar is alive, he will keep standing at the crossroads. He will safeguard them by holding their necks and legs unless they fall in the fire." Unquote. Having an insight into human psychology, he knew what makes one tick. He therefore did not allow eminent companions of the Prophet to leave Medina. He even told them that he was afraid of their dispersal in different countries. He knew that the complacency in this matter would give rise to complications in newly conquered regions. People will start gathering around those influential people, which will result in new groupings and groups coming into existence. All this, he had thought, would ultimately lead to friction and anarchy. A well-known writer and lawyer, Sayyid Amir Ali, who happened to be a Shia, writes about Umar, quote, "The short government of Abu Bakr was fully occupied with labor of pacifying the deserted tribes, to afford time for any systematic regulation of the provinces. But with the reign of Omar, a truly great man, commenced that sleepless care for the welfare of the subject nations which characterized the early Muslim governments. And another place he writes, quote, Omar's accession to the caliphate was of immense value to Islam. He was a man of strong moral fiber and keen sense of justice, possessed by great energy and a force of character, stern but just, far-sighted, thoroughly versed in the character of his people. He was especially fitted for the leadership of the unruly Arabs. He held the helm with a strong hand and severely repressed the natural tendency to demoralization amongst the nomadic tribes and semi-cultivated people who were coming in contact with luxury of the cities, of simple habits, austere, frugal, wandering about at the night to inquire into the conditions of the people without any guard or court, was the greatest and the most powerful ruler of the world, unquote. Sir William Muir has thus talked about the achievements of Omar, quote, so died Omar next to the Prophet, the greatest in the kingdom of Islam, for it was all within these 10 years, by his wisdom, patience, vigor, and dominion, was achieved over Syria, Egypt, Persia, which Islam had since maintained. Yet throughout his marvelous fortune, he never lost the equipoise of a wise and sober judgment, nor exalted himself above the frugal and familiar lifestyle of the Arab chief. Where is the Khalifa? Would the visitor from a distant province inquire, as he looked around the court of the Grand Mosque, and all the while the monarch was sitting humbly before him. Unquote. Expansion of the Islamic Empire under Omar. It is not possible even briefly to talk about the extensive conquests made under the reign of Khalifa Omar. The two great empires which had amongst themselves divided the civilized world and whose political, cultural, and social system had set the norms for others, were not only vanquished in the field of battle, but their possessions were also administered more efficiently and converted into blooming regions. Unruly lands were subjected to law and order, and new urban centers were brought into being. These are the matters which have been dealt with in greater detail in the annals of Islam and biographical works of Khalifa Omar. Ali and Khalifa Omar. It would, however, be worthwhile to refer to the camaraderie and the rapport between Ali and Omar and the affectionate regard they had for one another. To what extent one placed confidence in the other, how they cooperated in the matters of virtue and goodness, and how they conducted the affairs of the state through mutual consultation are adequately illustrated by the incidents narrated here. Naif Ali Ayethi relates, quote, once I entered the enclosure where the camels received by the way of charity were kept, along with Umar ibn al-Khattab and Ali ibn Abu Talib. Usman was sitting in the shade writing that Ali was dictating to him, standing in front of him, in accordance with the instructions of Omar. Umar was in the sun, clad in two wrappings, and the summer was extremely hot. He had covered his body with one and his head with the other, counting the camels received by the way of charity and giving out their color and the number of teeth each had to assess their age. Ali then said to Usman, for the best man that you can hire is the strong and the trustworthy, says a Quranic verse, and here pointing towards Omar, Omar is strong and trustworthy. Unquote. Quote, Ali acted as the most amicable and trustworthy advisor to Omar. He solved difficult problems in a satisfactory manner and left no doubt about the accuracy of his advice. Omar is reported to have once remarked, quote, Omar would have been nowhere if Ali would have not been with him. Unquote. In fact, Ali's wisdom became so proverbial that a number of later writers refer to his popular adage, quote, a complicated problem, but no Abul Hasan Even the Prophet had recognized his quality of Ali, for he is reported to have said, quote, "Ali is the most competent to solve enigmatic problems," unquote. When Omar set out for Jerusalem, he appointed Ali as his deputy. Ali had given his daughter Kulthum in marriage to Omar. This shows the cordial relationship and the regard Ali had for Omar. The sincerity of Ali. How earnest and sincere was Ali to the cause of Islam and the Muslims, and to what extent was he candid well-wisher of Omar, is revealed by his advice given on the occasion of the Battle of Nahawand. The judicious opinion expressed by Ali on that occasion is enough to show his wholeheartedness. The enemy was facing the Muslim army at Nahawand. After the Arabs had defeated the Persian general Al-Ula and captured Al-Ahwaz, the Persian established contact with their emperor, who was then in Mary. All the provisional governors from Al-Bab to Sindh and the rulers of Khorasan and Helwan responded with the alacrity to the call of their sovereign king for the final and desperate assault on the intruders of the desert. The Persian forces converged at Nahawand. The army thus commissioned by the Persians is reported to have 150,000, that means 150,000 people, far outnumbering the Arabs. Yezdard took recourse to every possible device, that is the king of Persia, to raise this army. He insisted his people in the name of religion and race to save the oldest empire from ruin. The sacred flag of the Persian Empire, decked with precious stones, was taken out, and since it was supposed to be for the victory of the Persians, the sacred fire was carried over the oratory along with the army, which marched to Nahawand under the command of the emperor's son, Mardan Shah. The Muslim general Saad informed Omar of the latest developments. Thereafter, he came to Medina and told Omar that the people at Kufa wanted permission to fall upon the Persians to give them a surprise. Omar convened a meeting of his advisors and told them, "The situation is extremely dangerous. I intend to collect an army and set out to establish a camp at some place between the two cities and direct the forces to fight the enemies of God till God opens the gates of victory for us and decide whatever he has willed. If God grants us victory, the enemy will be beaten in their own cities." Talha bin Ubaidullah replied, "You are better aware of the situation. Whatever decision you will take would be preferable. On our part, we will abide by your decision." Omar asked Usman. He said, "O Amirul Mukminin, that is the commander of the faithful, I will advise you to ask the people of Syria and Yemen to send their forces, and then you should lead an army recruited from the two holy cities and take the way through Kufa and Barsa so that all Muslims in the way might be drafted to face the enemy jointly." Omar then turned to Ali and asked for his opinion. Ali differed from the views expressed by others and advised Omar that he should not vacate Medina. He should remain here and entrust the command of the army to someone else. He also said that the governors of Basra and other people should send their troops to Iraq, but the governors should remain at their own places. He said if the Khalifa suffered a defeat or was killed, Islam and the Muslims would go all to pieces. Nothing would be possible and they would vanish into thin air. Omar agreed with Ali and acted on his advice. Omar inquired about the persons to be appointed commander-in-chief, and Ali said he should better belong to Iraq. The matter was left to be decided by him, and he selected Nauman bin al-Muqran al-Muzani for the post. The collection of Ali's sermons, letters, and utterances under the name of Najul Balagh, compiled by Sayyid Razi, held in great esteem by the Shia scholars, contained the conversations between Omar and Ali on the occasion of the Battle of Nahawand. Ali replied when consulted about Omar in the battle against the Persians, quote, "In this matter, victory or defeat is not dependent on the small or the big forces. It is Allah's religion, which He has raised above all faiths, and His army, which He has mobilized and extended, till it has reached a point where it stands now and has arrived at its current position. We hold a promise from Allah, and Allah would fulfill His promise and support His army. The position of the head of the government is that of the thread for the beads as it connects them and keeps them together. If the thread is broken, they would disperse and get lost and would never come back together again. The Arabs today, even small in number, are big because of Islam and strong because of unity. You should remain like the axis for them and rotate the will of the government with the help of the Arabs and be their root. Avoid battle, because if you leave the place, the Arabs will attack you from all sides and directions till the unguarded places left behind you would become more important than those before you. If the Persians see you tomorrow, they would have said, he is the chief of the Arabs. If we do away with him, we would be in peace. In this way, this would heighten the eagerness against you and keenness to aim at you. You say that they have set out to fight against the Muslims. Well, Allah detests these settings more than you do, and he is more capable of preventing what he detests. As regards to your idea about their large number, in the past we did not fight on the strength of large numbers, but we fought on the basis of Allah's support and his assistance. Unquote. Almost the same situation arose at the time of the Battle of Yarmouk, when Ali, asked by Omar to express his opinion, gave a correct advice which speaks of his absolute sincerity, and the Battle of Yarmouk was so decisive, for on it depended the possession of Syria and the further advancement of the Muslim army. Abu Ubaidah had informed the Khalifa that the Heraclius had come in person to Hems and from there sent out four separate armies by land and sea to crush the Arabs. Umar summoned the Ansar and the Muhajirin and read out the letter of Abu Ubaidah. The news caused great excitement in Medina. Some pleaded that they should be permitted to go to the theater of war, while Abdul Rahman bin Auf suggested that the commander of the Muslims should himself lead the army to Syria in order to help their brethren. Ali opposed his suggestion and said, quote, Allah has taken upon himself, for the followers of his religion, the strengthening of the boundaries and hiding of the secret places. Allah helped them when they were few and could not protect themselves. He is living and he will not die. If you will yourselves proceed towards the enemy and clash with them and fall in some trouble, there will be no place of refuge for the Muslims other than the remote cities, nor any place where they would return to. Therefore, you should send their experienced men and send with him and with all of them people of good performance and well-wishers. If Allah grants you victory, then it is what you want. If it is otherwise, you would serve as a support for the people and a returning place for the Muslims. One thing is quite apparent on the discourse of Ali. Had he borne any malice towards Omar or any grudge, or he considered Omar to be someone who has taken the office of the caliphate from him, he would have certainly welcomed the destruction of his enemy, particularly at a time when he was not to be held responsible for it in any manner. A battlefield is the most convenient place to get rid of someone. But Ali was far above such small-mindedness. He always advised in the best interest of the Muslims whenever any problem of collective good arose, which shows his sagacity and sincerity. May God reward him with the choicest returns on behalf of Islam and the Muslims, whose well-wisher he has always been. Ali, however, gave a contrary advice when the Patriarch of Palestine asked for peace but demanded the Khalifa to come in person for signing the treaty and taking over the keys of the city. Abu Ubaidah intimated the terms to Medina, whereupon Omar consulted the eminent Sahaba about the course of action to be taken. Usman expressed his view that the Khalifa should not go there, but force the army to surrender them. But Ali opined that Omar should go there on this momentous honor, which could have not had been at any other occasion. He also said that this would relieve the burden on Muslims. Omar agreed to the suggestion of Ali and set out to Syria in Rajab 16th AH, August 637 AD. He asked Ali to look after the affairs of the government in his absence. Journey of Omar to Syria. The journey of Omar was who was the conqueror of two great empires of his day, the Byzantines and the Persians, must be of interest to the readers. It was the occasion when pomp and ceremony would have been justified, if only to impress the newly subjected people of Jerusalem. Omar went and arrived at Jabiya riding a gray camel. A part of the scalp without his hair was shining in the sun, since he wore neither a cap or a turban on his head, and his legs were dangling on either side in the absence of any stirrups. He had the bedside, which he used as a saddle cloth while riding, and as a bed when he dismounted to take rest. His another possession was a leather bag stuffed with date palm leaves, which served as a purpose of a pillow while taking rest. He wore a coarse cotton shirt with numerous stains and slits there, here and there, quote, unquote. Quote, Omar asked to send for the chief of those people in a town during the journey. When he came, Omar gave him his shirt to be washed and repaired. He also asked him to lend him a shirt for some time. He immediately produced a shirt made of fine cloth. Omar inquired about the cloth and then put it on. No sooner his shirt washed and repaired was brought back that he put off the shirt that he had lent to him and changed into his own shirt. The Christian chief said to Omar, quote, "You are the king of Arabia. The camel is treated unseemingly for riding in this country, so put on a robe of fine clothes and take a mule for your ride instead of a camel. This will enhance your esteem in the eyes of the Romans." Omar replied, quote, "The honor we enjoy is due to Islam. We cannot adopt anything except what is pleasing to God." A mule was brought on which he placed his tunic, for it had no saddle or reins. He mounted on it and said very next moment, "Hold it, hold it. If I had never earlier seen any people riding a devil." His camel was brought again and he rode on it. It would be worthwhile to give there an account of the second journey of Omar to Syria, undertaken in 18 AH, taken from Sir William Moore, quote, "Annals of the Early Caliphate," unquote. Omar set out after appointing Ali to deputize for him in Medina. His words go as the following, quote, "This his way lay through the Christian settlements of Alia at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba. The reception he met there brings out well the simplicity of Omar and his kindly feelings towards the Christians. He journeyed on a camel with small pomp or following, and as he was minded to enter the village unrecognized, he changed places with his servant. 'Where is the Amir?' cried the eager crowds as they streamed forward from the villages to witness the Khalifa. 'He is before you,' replied Omar, and he drove his camel on. So they hurried forward, thinking that the great Khalifa was beyond, and they left Omar to go and see for him at the house of a bishop with whom he lodged during the heat of the day." Unquote. Omar's relationship with the Prophet's household. With the awe Omar commanded and his strictness in the affairs of government and restoring justice to the people, he had a close relationship with the Prophet's household and was consistently considerate to the progeny of the Prophet. He always gave preference to the descendants of the Prophet over his own children and other members of his family. Several instances of this type have been related, on which few are given here. Among the events reported by Hussein bin Ali, the son of Ali, one says about an occasion, quote, "One day Omar said to me, 'My son, come on occasions to see me.' Accordingly, I went to see him at a time when he was in camera talking to someone. His son was standing there outside and he had not been permitted to enter the room. I returned, but after a few days, Umar saw me and complained, 'My son, you did not come to see me.' I replied, 'I came, but you were talking to somebody else. I found your son waiting for you, so I went back.' Umar said, 'You are more entitled to get permission for coming in than Abdullah bin Umar. The faith that had been ingrained in our hearts and minds is a grace from God.' Then putting his hand on his head, he added, 'It was due to your household that we got it.'" Unquote. Ibn Sa'd narrates from Ja'far as-Sadiq bin Muhammad al-Baqir, who heard his father Ali bin Hussein saying, quote, Omar received a few pairs of shirts and trousers from Yemen. He distributed them amongst the people who came donning that dress to the Prophet's mosque. Omar sat between the pulpit and the Prophet's grave, receiving the greetings of the incomers and replying to them. Then entered Hassan and Hussein, coming out of the house of their mother Fatima. But they were not putting on the new dresses. Omar was sad, and when he was asked the reason for it, he said, I feel sorry for these boys since I had no dress of their size. The garments were large and the boys are small. Thereafter, he sent a messenger to Yemen to send two pairs for Hassan and Hussein at the earliest. These were received and Umar felt satisfied when they got to be dressed in them. He also narrates one more incident as the following. Quote, After the doors of conquest was opened by Allah, Umar intended to fix a monthly and a daily stipend for each person. But he summoned the elder companions to decide the categories and amounts of stipend to be given to different people. He asked them to express their views. Abdurrahman bin Auf opined, Begin it with yourself. Omar replied, By God, I will begin it from people who are nearest to Allah's apostle and then fix the stipend for Banu Hashim. Accordingly, he first allocated stipends for Abbas and Ali and categorized his own clan, Banu Adi, after five other clans. Thereafter, he placed the people of Banu Umayyah bin Abdus Shams, who had fought in the Battle of Badr. The rule followed for allocation of stipend was the nearest in kinship. The first priority was given to Hassan and Hussein, who had been nearest to the Prophet. Unquote. In regard to the respectful attachment Umar had for the family of the Prophet, Shibli Nomani writes in Al Farooq, quote, Omar never took any action in serious or grave matters without first consulting Ali, who was the most sincere and frank in giving his advice. When he went to Jerusalem, he entrusted the charge of the caliphate to Ali. The climax of their harmony and affinity was when Ali gave Kulthum, his daughter by Fatima, in marriage to Omar. Ali gave the name of Omar to one of his sons and Abu Bakr to one of his sons and Usman to her third son. It was a common practice that people name their sons after people that they hold dear or regard as ideal people. Unquote. The inception of Islamic calendar. One of the greatest achievements of Ali, which will last till time to come and Islam and the Muslims survive, was the determination of the beginning of the Islamic calendar. In the days of Umar, different methods were used for recording events and happenings. There also existed difference of opinions on the dating of the events. Some favored the regal year beginning from the birth or the coronation of the ruler, as was the practice of the Persians, while others wanted to adopt a system similar to the Byzantines. Some companions were of the opinion that the Islamic calendar should commence the day of the Prophet was bestowed Prophethood. Ali suggested that the day when the Prophet migrated from Makkah to Medina should be taken as the beginning of the Islamic era. Umar and all opinion and all companions agreed to the suggestion of Ali, and Umar accordingly directed that the events should be assigned a date calculated from the day of the Prophet's migration to Medina. Generally, the inception of a calendar is related to the birth and death of a great personality or the establishment of an empire. It is the peculiarity of Islam that it is not named after its prophet, nor is its calendar associated with any person, including the Prophet of Islam, who was the greatest man born on earth and the most admired people by God and the Muslims. It was not related to the victories won by the adherents of Islam. Inception of its character, inception of the calendar of Islam from the date of migration of the Prophet is indicative of the peculiar thought and the underlying wisdom, since it points to the message of Islam. Anyone trying to go into its origin would know that Islam gives significance only to the faithful and the creed, and considers it worth being commemorated. Now, the conservation of creed in preference to all other things generally valued and taken pride of indicates that the triumph of faith or ideal really constitutes the occasion for beginning of a new era in human history. It also contains the lesson that the principle or doctrine has precedence over all events, the happenings, and that man should be prepared to face all hardship for the sake of it. The martyrdom of Umar ibn al-Khattab. Umar never allowed zimmi, that is, protected people, paying a special tax in consideration of being exempted from military duty, to enter Medina. Mughira bin Shu'ba, while acting as a governor of Kufa, had sought permission of the Khalif for his slave Abu Lu'lu, who was a master craftsman, to reside in Medina. His name was really Firoz, and he was a Persian, subscribing to the Magian faith. Some, however, claim that he was a Christian. During the war with the Byzantines, and that Persia had been taken captive by the Byzantines, later on he was sent to Medina with other captives and slaves in 642, after the victory in the Battle of Nahwand. Whenever Abu Lu'lu saw any Persian boy in Medina, he used to melt into tears and hug him and say, "Umar has eaten my heart." Mughira had a financial interest in having Abu Lu'lu in Medina, for the latter was a master craftsman, expert in blacksmithry, carpentry, and engraving. He used to make stone mills, for which Mughira paid him 4 dirhams daily out of his earnings. One day he called upon Umar and complained that Mughira made him work very hard, and therefore he might be asked to charge less out of his wages. Umar asked about the work he was doing, and was on being told about it, he said, "Keeping in view of the work that you do and the amount charged by Mughira is not excessive. Fear God and serve your master faithfully." Umar had thought that he would ask Mughira, whenever he met him next, to be more lenient to his slave Abu Lu'lu. But Abu Lu'lu was filled with anger. He made a double-edged dagger and also poisoned it. He even met old Persian chieftain Hormuzan and asked his view about the quality of the dagger. He was satisfied on being told that no man could survive after receiving a wound from it. In fact, it was an Iranian Magian conspiracy at work, fueled both by personal spite and national racial fervor. The day Umar was assassinated, Abdurrahman bin Abu Bakr had seen Hormuzan, Abu Lu'lu, and Jufayna speaking in whispers, and a dagger falling down accidentally at the time. Several historians have therefore put forth the view that the assassination of Umar was a planned conspiracy of the Jews and the Iranians. There is nothing queer in it, for a people who have lost their country and freedom can do anything to avenge their spite, particularly if it happens to satisfy their national pride. Umar had taken the position to lead the Fajr prayers. People standing behind Umar heard the takbir and then a sudden cry, "The dog has killed me." Abu Lu'lu assaulted Umar 6 times and inflicted wounds in the shoulder and the hips. Thereafter, Abu Lu'lu decamped with the dagger and stabbed whoever came in his way. Thus, 13 people were inflicted injuries by him. Abdurrahman bin Auf promptly threw a large cloak over him. Getting entangled, he fell down and slit his throat for the fear of being caught. Umar, on the other hand, fell down saying, "Commandment of Allah is certain destiny." Umar asked who had attacked him. When he was told that it was slave of Mughira bin Shu'ba, he said, "Thank God, my assassin is not someone who even prostrated before God that he may altercate with him on the day of judgment. It was not a deed of an Arab." Unquote. Umar sent for his son, Abdullah bin Umar, and asked him to go to Aisha and seek her permission for burial beside the grave of the Prophet. He also instructed his son not to refer to him as Amirul Mukminin, or the commander of the faithful, because he was no longer their chief. Abdullah called upon Aisha, who was crying. He conveyed greetings of Umar and his request. Aisha replied, "I wanted to save that spot for myself, but today I will give my preference to Umar." When Abdullah returned with the reply from Aisha, Umar said, "Alhamdulillah, praise be to God. I esteemed nothing more than that grave." Then he added, "But see, when I die, take my body on a coat and keep it at the door. Ask her permission again. If she refuses, bury me in a cemetery with other Muslims. I am afraid that she might have granted permission because of my position. When his dead body was taken for burial, the Muslims were overwhelmed with grief, as there had been no such adversity before. Aisha again gave her permission and he was laid to rest. He found his eternal resting place by the side of the Prophet and Abu Bakr. The death of Umar was a real calamity to Islam, and the calamitous day was 26th Zilhijjah, that is the 3rd of November 644. Umar was 63 years of age. The grief of Ali bin Abu Talib. Abu Hujayfa relates, quote, Umar had died and his dead body lay covered with the mantle. It was there then Ali came. He uncovered Umar's face and said, Abu Hafs, Allah may have his mercy on you. By Allah, there is nobody besides Allah's Prophet and you, with whose record of deeds I would like to turn up before God. Unquote. It has been reported that Ali was shedding tears after Umar died. When he was asked the reason for it, he replied, I am lamenting the death of Umar. His death has created a crack in Islam, which will not be fulfilled till the end of time. Jazakallah khair. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.